Both were talking and listening too eagerly and too naturally, which was why Anna Pavlovna disapproved. The means are the balance of power in Europe and the rights of the people, the Abbé was saying. It is only necessary for one powerful nation like Russia, barbaric as she is said to be, to place herself disinterestedly at the head of an alliance having for its object the maintenance of the balance of power in Europe, and it would save the world. But how are you to get that balance? Pierre was beginning. At that moment Anna Pavlovna came up, and, looking severely at Pierre, asked the Italian how he stood the Russian climate. The Italian's face instantly changed and assumed an offensively affected, sugary expression, evidently habitual to him when conversing with women. I am so enchanted by the brilliancy of the wit and culture of the society, more especially of the feminine society, in which I have had the honor of being received, that I have not yet had time to think of the climate, said he. Not letting the Abbé and Pierre escape, Anna Pavlovna, the more conveniently to keep them under observation, brought them into the larger circle. Just then, another visitor entered the drawing-room, Prince Andrew Bolkonski, the little princess's husband. He was a very handsome young man of medium height, with firm, clear-cut features. Everything about him, from his weary, bored expression to his quiet, measured step, offered a most striking contrast to his lively little wife. It was evident that he not only knew everyone in the drawing-room, but had found them to be so tiresome that it wearied him to look at or to listen to them. And among all these faces that he found so tedious, none seemed to bore him so much as that of his pretty wife. He turned away from her with a grimace that distorted his handsome face, kissed Anna Pavlovna's hand, and, screwing up his eyes, scanned the whole company. "You're off to the war, Prince?" said Anna Pavlovna.
"General Kutuzov," said Bolkonski, speaking French and stressing the last syllable of the general's name like a Frenchman, "has been pleased to take me as an aide-de-camp."
"And Lise, your wife?"
"She will go to the country."
"Are you not ashamed to deprive us of your charming wife?"
"André," said his wife, addressing her husband in the same coquettish manner in which she spoke to other men, "the Vicomte has been telling us such a tale about Mademoiselle Georges and Bonaparte."
Prince Andrew screwed up his eyes and turned away. Pierre, who from the moment Prince Andrew entered the room had watched him with glad, affectionate eyes, now came up and took his arm. Before he looked round, Prince Andrew frowned again, expressing his annoyance with whoever was touching his arm. But when he saw Pierre's beaming face, he gave him an unexpectedly kind and pleasant smile. "There now, so you too are in the great world?" said he to Pierre.
"I knew you would be here," replied Pierre. "I will come to supper with you. May I?" he added in a low voice so as not to disturb the Vicomte, who was continuing his story.
"No, impossible," said Prince Andrew, laughing and pressing Pierre's hand to show that there was no need to ask the question. He wished to say something more, but at that moment Prince Vasily and his daughter got up to go, and the two young men rose to let them pass.
"You must excuse me, my dear Vicomte," said Prince Vasily to the Frenchman, holding him down by the sleeve in a friendly way to prevent his rising. "This unfortunate fate at the ambassador's deprives me of a pleasure and obliges me to interrupt you. I'm very sorry to leave your enchanting party," said he, turning to Anna Pavlovna.
His daughter, Princess Hélène, passed between the chairs, lightly holding up the folds of her dress, and the smile shone still more radiantly on her beautiful face. Pierre gazed at her with rapturous, almost frightened eyes as she passed him.
"Very lovely," said Prince Andrew.
"Very," said Pierre. In passing, Prince Vasily seized Pierre's hand and said to Anna Pavlovna,
"Educate this bear for me. He's been staying with me a whole month, and this is the first time I've seen him in society. Nothing is so necessary for a young man as the society of clever women."
Anna Pavlovna smiled and promised to take Pierre in hand. She knew his father to be a connection of Prince Vasily's. The elderly lady who had been sitting with the old aunt rose hurriedly and overtook Prince Vasily in the anteroom. All the affectation of interest she had assumed had left her kindly and tear-worn face, and it now expressed only anxiety and fear.
"How about my son Boris, Prince?" said she, hurrying after him into the anteroom. "I can't remain any longer in Petersburg. Tell me what news I may take back to my poor boy."
Although Prince Vasily listened reluctantly and not very politely to the elderly lady, even betraying some impatience, she gave him an ingratiating and appealing smile and took his hand that he might not go away.
"What would it cost you to say a word to the Emperor, and then he would be transferred to the guards at once?" said she.
"Believe me, Princess, I am ready to do all I can," answered Prince Vasily. "But it is difficult for me to ask the Emperor. I should advise you to appeal to Rumyantsev through Prince Golitsyn. That would be the best way."
The elderly lady was a Princess Drubetskaya, belonging to one of the best families in Russia, but she was poor, and having long been out of society, had lost her former influential connections. She had now come to Petersburg to procure an appointment in the Guards for her only son. It was, in fact, solely to meet Prince Vasily that she had obtained an invitation to Anna Pavlovna's reception and had sat listening to the Vicomte's story. Prince Vasily's words frightened her. An embittered look clouded her once handsome face, but only for a moment. Then she smiled again and clutched Prince Vasily's arm more tightly.
"Listen to me, Prince," said Princess Drubetskaya. "I've never yet asked you for anything, and I never will again. Nor have I ever reminded you of my father's friendship for you. But now I entreat you, for God's sake, to do this for my son, and I shall always regard you as a benefactor," she added hurriedly. "No, don't be angry, but promise. I have asked Golitsyn, and he has refused. Be the kind-hearted man you always were," she said, trying to smile, though tears were in her eyes.
"Papa, we shall be late," said Princess Hélène, turning her beautiful head and looking over her classically molded shoulder as she stood waiting by the door.
Influence in society, however, is capital which has to be economized if it is to last. Prince Vasily knew this, and having once realized that if he asked on behalf of all who begged of him, he would soon be unable to ask for himself, he became chary of using his influence. But in Princess Drubetskaya's case, he felt, after her second appeal, something like qualms of conscience. She had reminded him of what was quite true. He had been indebted to her father for the first steps in his career. Moreover, he could see by her manners that she was one of those women, mostly mothers, who, having once made up their minds, will not rest until they have gained their end, and are prepared, if necessary, to go on insisting day after day and hour after hour, and even to make scenes. This last consideration moved him.
"My dear Anna Mikhailovna," said he with his usual familiarity and weariness of tone, "it is almost impossible for me to do what you ask. But to prove my devotion to you and how I respect your father's memory, I will do the impossible. Your son shall be transferred to the guards. Here is my hand on it. Are you satisfied?"
"My dear benefactor, this is what I expected from you. I knew your kindness."
He turned to go.
"Wait, just a word. When he's been transferred to the guards," she faltered. "You are on good terms with Michael Ilarionovich Kutuzov?"
Note: in 1805, M.I. Kutuzov, 1745 to 1813, already enjoyed a great military reputation. He had taken part in the Turkish wars in Catherine's reign, and together with Suvorov had captured the fortresses of Ochakov and Ismail, but was seriously wounded and lost an eye. Having displeased Alexander in the post of Governor-General of Petersburg, he had been living for 3 years in disfavor in the country, but was now recalled to lead an army of 50,000 men to the aid of Austria.
"You are on good terms with Michael Ilarionovich Kutuzov. Recommend Boris to him as adjutant. Then I shall be at rest, and then..."
Prince Vasily smiled.
"No, I won't promise that. You don't know how Kutuzov is pestered since his appointment as commander-in-chief. He told me himself that all the Moscow ladies have conspired to give him all their sons as adjutants."
"No, but do promise. I won't let you go. My dear benefactor..."
"Papa," said his beautiful daughter in the same tone as before, "we shall be late." "Well, au revoir. Goodbye. You hear?
Then tomorrow you will speak to the Emperor?" "Certainly, but about Kutuzov I don't promise."
"Do promise, do promise, Vasily," cried Anna Mikhailovna as he went. With the smile of a coquettish girl, which at one time probably came naturally to her, but was now very ill-suited to her careworn face. Apparently she had forgotten her age, and by force of habit employed all the old feminine arts. But as soon as the prince had gone, her face resumed its former cold, artificial expression. She returned to the group where the Vicomte was still talking, and again pretended to listen, while waiting till it would be time to leave. Her task was accomplished.
"And what do you think of this latest comedy, The Coronation at Milan?" asked Anna Pavlovna. "And of the comedy of the people of Genoa and Lucca laying their petitions before Monsieur Buonaparte, and Monsieur Buonaparte sitting on a throne and granting the petitions of the nations. Adorable! It's enough to make one's head whirl. It's as if the whole world had gone crazy."
Prince Andrew looked Anna Pavlovna straight in the face with a sarcastic smile. "Dieu me la donne, gare à qui la touche. God has given it to me, let him who touches it beware." Bonaparte's words at his coronation.
"They say he was very fine when he said that," he remarked, repeating the words in Italian.
"Dio mi l'ha dato, guai a chi la tocchi."
"I hope this will prove the last drop that will make the glass run over," Anna Pavlovna continued. "The sovereigns will not be able to endure this man who is a menace to everything."
"The sovereigns. I do not speak of Russia," said the Vicomte, polite but hopeless. "The sovereigns, madame. What have they done for Louis XVII, for the Queen, or for Madame Elizabeth? Nothing."
Note, the Vicomte de Mortemart refers to the fact that the sovereigns of Europe had saved neither the son, the wife, nor the sister of Louis XVI from execution or death in prison. He became more animated. "And believe me, they are reaping the reward of their betrayal of the Bourbon cause. The sovereigns! Why, they are sending ambassadors to compliment the usurper." And sighing disdainfully, he again changed his position. Prince Hippolyte, who had been gazing at the Vicomte for some time through his lorgnette, suddenly turned completely round toward the little princess, and having asked for a needle, began tracing the Condé coat of arms on the table. He explained this to her with as much gravity as if she had asked him to do it. "Bâton de gueule, engrelée de gueule d'azur, Maison Condé," said he. Note, Hippolyte's heraldry, like the rest of his conversation and conduct, is that of an utter fool. The arms of Condé are d'or à la face de gueule, or a fesse gueule. What Hippolyte says they are is untranslatable nonsense. The princess listened, smiling.
"If Buonaparte remains on the throne of France a year longer," the Vicomte continued, with the air of a man who, in a matter with which he is better acquainted than anyone else, does not listen to others but follows the current of his own thoughts, "things will have gone too far. By intrigues, violence, exile, and executions, French society, I mean good French society, will have been forever destroyed. And then..." He shrugged his shoulders and spread out his hands. Pierre wished to make a remark, for the conversation interested him, but Anna Pavlovna, who had him under observation, interrupted. "The Emperor Alexander," said she, with the melancholy which always accompanied any reference of hers to the imperial family, "has declared that he will leave it to the French people themselves to choose their own form of government, and I believe that, once free from the usurper, the whole nation will certainly throw itself into the arms of its rightful king," she concluded, trying to be amiable to the royalist emigrant.
"That is doubtful," said Prince Andrew. "Monsieur le Vicomte quite rightly supposes that matters have already gone too far. I think it will be difficult to return to the old regime."
"From what I have heard," said Pierre, blushing and breaking into the conversation, "almost all the aristocracy has already gone over to Bonaparte's side."
"It is the Buonapartists who say that," replied the Vicomte without looking at Pierre. "At the present time it is difficult to know the real state of French public opinion."
"Bonaparte has said so," remarked Prince Andrew with a sarcastic smile. It was evident that he did not like the Vicomte, and was aiming his remarks at him, though without looking at him. I showed them the path to glory, but they did not follow it. Prince Andrew continued after a short silence, again quoting Napoleon's words. I opened my antechambers, and they crowded in. I do not know how far he was justified in saying so.
Not in the least, replied the Vicomte. After the murder of the Duke, even the most partial ceased to regard him as a hero. If to some people, he went on, turning to Anna Pavlovna, he ever was a hero, after the murder of the Duke there was one martyr more in heaven and one hero less on earth.
Before Anna Pavlovna and the others had time to smile their appreciation of the Vicomte's epigram, Pierre again broke into the conversation, and though Anna Pavlovna felt sure he would say something inappropriate, she was unable to stop him. The execution of the Duc d'Enghien, declared Monsieur Pierre, was a political necessity, and it seems to me that Napoleon showed greatness of soul by not fearing to take on himself the whole responsibility of that deed.
Dieu, mon Dieu,
muttered Anna Pavlovna in a terrified whisper.
What, Monsieur Pierre, do you consider that assassination shows greatness of soul? Said the little princess, smiling and drawing her work nearer to her.
Oh, oh, exclaimed several voices.
Capital,
said Prince Hippolyte in English, and began slapping his knee with the palm of his hand. The Vicomte merely shrugged his shoulders. Pierre looked solemnly at his audience over his spectacles and continued.
I say so, he continued desperately, because the Bourbons fled from the revolution, leaving the people to anarchy, and Napoleon alone understood the revolution and quelled it, and so, for the general good, he could not stop short for the sake of one man's life.
Won't you come over to the other table, suggested Anna Pavlovna. But Pierre continued his speech without heeding her.
No, cried he, becoming more and more eager. Napoleon is great because he rose superior to the revolution, suppressed its abuses, preserved all that was good in it, equality of citizenship and freedom of speech and of the press, and only for that reason did he obtain power.
Yes, if having obtained power, without availing himself of it to commit murder, he had restored it to the rightful king, I should have called him a great man, remarked the Vicomte.
He could not do that. The people only gave him power that he might rid them of the Bourbons, and because they saw that he was a great man. The revolution was a grand thing, continued Monsieur Pierre,
betraying by this desperate and provocative proposition his extreme youth and his wish to express all that was in his mind.
What? Revolution and regicide a grand thing? Well, after that, but won't you come to this other table? Repeated Anna Pavlovna.
Rousseau's Contrat Social, said the Vicomte with a tolerant smile.
I'm not speaking of regicide, I'm speaking about ideas.
Yes, ideas of robbery, murder, and regicide, again interjected an ironical voice.
Those were extremes, no doubt, but they're not what is most important. What is important are the rights of man, emancipation from prejudices, and equality of citizenship, and all these ideas Napoleon has retained in full force.
Liberty and equality, said the Vicomte contemptuously, as if at last deciding seriously to prove to this youth how foolish his words were. High-sounding words which have long been discredited. Who does not love liberty and equality? Even our Savior preached liberty and equality. Have people since the revolution become happier? On the contrary, we wanted liberty, but Bonaparte has destroyed it.
Prince Andrew kept looking with an amused smile from Pierre to the Vicomte, and from the Vicomte to their hostess. In the first moment of Pierre's outburst, Anna Pavlovna, despite her social experience, was horror-struck. But when she saw that Pierre's sacrilegious words had not exasperated the Vicomte, and had convinced herself that it was impossible to stop him, she rallied her forces and joined the Vicomte in a vigorous attack on the orator.
But, my dear Monsieur Pierre, said she, how do you explain the fact of a great man executing a duke, or even an ordinary man, who is innocent and untried?
I should like, said the Vicomte, to ask how Monsieur explains the 18th Brumaire.
Note, the 9th of November, according to the French Revolutionary calendar, the day on which Napoleon overthrew the existing French Revolutionary government by a coup d'etat, which led to his becoming first consul.
Was not that an imposture? It was a swindle, and not at all like the conduct of a great man. And the prisoners he killed in Africa, That was horrible, said the little princess, shrugging her shoulders.
He's a low fellow, say what you will, remarked Prince Hippolyte.
Pierre, not knowing whom to answer, looked at them all and smiled. His smile was unlike the half-smile of other people. When he smiled, his grave, even rather gloomy look was instantaneously replaced by another, a childlike, kindly, even rather silly look which seemed to ask forgiveness. The Vicomte, who was meeting him for the first time, saw clearly that this young Jacobin was not so terrible as his words suggested. All were silent.
"How do you expect him to answer you all at once?" said Prince Andrew.
"Besides, in the actions of a statesman one has to distinguish between his acts as a private person, as a general, and as an emperor. So it seems to me."
"Yes, yes, of course," Pierre chimed in, pleased at the arrival of this reinforcement.
"One must admit," continued Prince Andrew, "that Napoleon as a man was great on the bridge of Arcole, and in the hospital at Jaffa, where he gave his hand to the plague-stricken. But there are other acts which it is difficult to justify."
Note, Napoleon, with standard in hand, had faced the Austrian fire and captured the bridge at Arcole near Verona, Italy, November 15th to 17th, 1796. He had taken Jaffa, a seaport in Palestine, on March 7th, 1799, where he visited the hospital referred to in the text.
Prince Andrew, who had evidently wished to tone down the awkwardness of Pierre's remarks, rose and made a sign to his wife that it was time to go. Suddenly, Prince Hippolyte started up, making signs to everyone to attend, and asking them all to be seated again.
"I was told a charming Moscow story today and must treat you to it. Excuse me, Vicomte, I must tell it in Russian, or the point will be lost."
And Prince Hippolyte began to tell his story in such Russian as a Frenchman would speak after spending about a year in Russia. Everyone waited, so emphatically and eagerly did he demand their attention to his story. "There is in Moscow a lady, une dame, and she is very stingy. She must have two footmen behind her carriage and very big ones. That was her taste. And she had a lady's maid, also big. She said..." Here Prince Hippolyte paused, evidently collecting his ideas with difficulty. "She said..." "Oh, yes, she said, 'Girl,' to the maid, 'put on a livery. Get up behind the carriage and come with me while I make some calls.'"
Here Prince Hippolyte spluttered and burst out laughing long before his audience, which produced an effect unfavorable to the narrator. Several persons, among them the elderly lady and Anna Pavlovna, did, however, smile.
"She went. Suddenly there was a great wind. The girl lost her hat, and her long hair came down."
Here he could contain himself no longer and went on between gasps of laughter.
"And the whole world knew."
And so the anecdote ended. Though it was unintelligible why he had told it, or why it had to be told in Russian, still Anna Pavlovna and the others appreciated Prince Hippolyte's social tact in so agreeably ending Pierre's unpleasant and unamiable outburst. After the anecdote, the conversation broke up into insignificant small talk about the last and next balls, about theatricals, and who would meet whom, and when, and where.
Chapter 2. Pierre at Prince Andrew's. Having thanked Anna Pavlovna for her charming soiree, the guests began to take their leave. Pierre was ungainly. Stout, about the average height, broad, with huge red hands, he did not know, as the saying is, how to enter a drawing room, and still less how to leave one, that is, how to say something particularly agreeable before going away. Besides this, he was absent-minded. When he rose to go, he took up instead of his own the general's three-cornered hat and held it, pulling at the plume, till the general asked him to restore it. All his absent-mindedness and inability to enter a room and converse in it was, however, redeemed by his kindly, simple, and modest expression. Anna Pavlovna turned toward him, and with a Christian mildness that expressed forgiveness of his indiscretion, nodded and said, "I hope to see you again, but I also hope you will change your opinions, my dear Monsieur Pierre." When she said this, he did not reply, and only bowed, but again everybody saw his smile, which said nothing unless, perhaps, opinions are opinions,
but you see what a capital, good-natured fellow I am. And everyone, including Anna Pavlovna, felt this. Prince Andrew had gone out into the hall, and turning his shoulders to the footman who was helping him on with his cloak, listened indifferently to his wife's chatter with Prince Hippolyte, who had also come into the hall. Prince Hippolyte stood close to the pretty, pregnant princess and stared fixedly at her through his eyeglass. "Go in, Annette, or you will catch cold," said the little princess, taking leave of Anna Pavlovna. "It is settled," she added in a low voice. Anna Pavlovna had already managed to speak to Lise about the match she contemplated between Anatole and the little princess's sister-in-law. "I rely on you, my dear," said Anna Pavlovna, also in a low tone. "Write to her, and let me know how her father looks at the matter. Au revoir." And she left the hall. Prince Hippolyte approached the little princess, and, bending his face close to her, began to whisper something. Two footmen, the princess's and his own, stood holding a shawl and a cloak, waiting for the conversation to finish. They listened to the French sentences, which to them were meaningless, with an air of understanding, but not wishing to appear to do so. The princess, as usual, spoke smilingly and listened with a laugh. "I'm very glad I did not go to the ambassador's," said Prince Hippolyte. "So dull. It has been a delightful evening, has it not?" "Delightful." "They say the ball will be very good," replied the princess, drawing up her downy little lip. "All the pretty women in society will be there."
"Not all, for you will not be there." "Not all," said Prince Hippolyte, smiling joyfully. And snatching the shawl from the footman, whom he even pushed aside, he began wrapping it round the princess. Either from awkwardness or intentionally, no one could have said which, after the shawl had been adjusted, he kept his arm around her for a long time as though embracing her. Still smiling, she gracefully moved away, turning and glancing at her husband. Prince Andrew's eyes were closed, so weary and sleepy did he seem. "Are you ready?" he asked his wife, looking past her. Prince Hippolyte hurriedly put on his cloak, which in the latest fashion reached to his very heels, and, stumbling in it, ran out into the porch, following the princess, whom a footman was helping into the carriage. "Princess, au revoir!" cried he, stumbling with his tongue as well as with his feet. The princess, picking up her dress, was taking her seat in the dark carriage. Her husband was adjusting his saber. Prince Hippolyte, under pretense of helping, was in everyone's way. "Allow me, sir," said Prince Andrew in Russian, in a cold, disagreeable tone to Prince Hippolyte, who was blocking his path. "I am expecting you, Pierre," said the same voice, but gently and affectionately. The postillion started, the carriage wheels rattled. Prince Hippolyte laughed spasmodically as he stood in the porch waiting for the Vicomte, whom he had promised to take home. "Well, mon cher," said the Vicomte, having seated himself beside Hippolyte in the carriage, "your little princess is very nice. Very nice indeed. Quite French." And he kissed the tips of his fingers. Hippolyte burst out laughing. "Do you know, you're a terrible chap for all your innocent airs," continued the Vicomte. "I pity the poor husband, that little officer who gives himself the airs of a monarch." Hippolyte spluttered again, and amid his laughter said, "And you were saying that the Russian ladies are not equal to the French? One has to know how to deal with them." Pierre, reaching the house first, went into Prince Andrew's study like one quite at home, and from habit immediately lay down on the sofa, took from the shelf the first book that came to his hand, it was Caesar's Commentaries, and resting on his elbow began reading it in the middle. "What have you done to Mademoiselle Scherer? She will be quite ill now," said Prince Andrew as he entered the study, rubbing his small white hands. Pierre turned his whole body, making the sofa creak. He lifted his eager face to Prince Andrew, smiled, and waved his hand. "That abbé is very interesting, but he does not see the thing in the right light. In my opinion, perpetual peace is possible, but I do not know how to express it, not by a balance of political power." It was evident that Prince Andrew was not interested in such abstract conversation. "One can't everywhere say all one thinks, mon cher." "Well, have you at last decided on anything? Are you going to be a guardsman or a diplomatist?" asked Prince Andrew after a momentary silence. Pierre sat up on the sofa with his legs tucked under him. "Really, I don't yet know.
I don't like the one or the other.
But you must decide on something. Your father expects it.
Pierre, at the age of 10, had been sent abroad with an abbé as tutor, and had remained away till he was 20. When he returned to Moscow, his father dismissed the abbé and said to the young man, "Now go to Petersburg, look round, and choose your profession. I will agree to anything. Here is a letter to Prince Vasily, and here is money. Write to me all about it, and I will help you in everything." Pierre had already been choosing a career for 3 months and had not decided on anything. It was about this choice that Prince Andrew was speaking. Pierre rubbed his forehead. "But he must be a Freemason," said he, referring to the abbé whom he had met that evening.
"That is all nonsense," Prince Andrew again interrupted him. "Let us talk business. Have you been to the Horse Guards?"
"No, I have not. But this is what I've been thinking and wanted to tell you. There is a war now against Napoleon. If it were a war for freedom, I could understand it and should be the first to enter the army. But to help England and Austria against the greatest man in the world is not right."
Prince Andrew only shrugged his shoulders at Pierre's childish words. He put on the air of one who finds it impossible to reply to such nonsense, but it would in fact have been difficult to give any other answer than the one Prince Andrew gave to this naive question. "If no one fought except on his own conviction, there would be no wars," he said.
"And that would be splendid," said Pierre.
Prince Andrew smiled ironically. "Very likely it would be splendid, but it will never come about."
"Well, why are you going to the war?" asked Pierre.
"What for? I don't know. I must. Besides that, I'm going..." He paused. "I'm going because the life I'm leading here does not suit me."
The rustle of a woman's dress was heard in the next room. Prince Andrew shook himself as if waking up, and his face assumed the look it had in Anna Pavlovna's drawing room. Pierre removed his feet from the sofa. The princess came in. She had changed her gown for a house dress as fresh and elegant as the other. Prince Andrew rose and politely placed a chair for her. "How is it," she began, as usual in French, settling down briskly and fussily in the easy chair, "how is it Annette never got married? How stupid you men all are not to have married her. Excuse me for saying so, but you have no sense about women. What an argumentative fellow you are, Monsieur Pierre."
"And I'm still arguing with your husband."
"I can't understand why he wants to go to the war," replied Pierre, addressing the princess with none of the embarrassment so commonly shown by young men in their intercourse with young women.
The princess started. Evidently Pierre's words touched her to the quick.
"Ah, that is just what I tell him," said she. "I don't understand it. I don't in the least understand why men can't live without wars. How is it that we women don't want anything of the kind, don't need it? Now, you shall judge between us. I always tell him, here he is, uncle's aide-de-camp, a most brilliant position. He's so well known, so much appreciated by everyone. The other day at the Apraxins I heard a lady asking, 'Is that the famous Prince Andrew?' I did indeed."
She laughed.
"He's so well received everywhere. He might easily become aide-de-camp to the Emperor. You know, the Emperor spoke to him most graciously. Annette and I were speaking of how to arrange it. What do you think?"
Pierre looked at his friend, and, noticing that he did not like the conversation, gave no reply.
"When are you starting?" Pierre asked Prince Andrew. "Oh, don't speak of his going, don't. I won't hear it spoken of," said the princess, in the same petulantly playful tone in which she had spoken to Hippolyte in the drawing-room, and which was so plainly ill-suited to the family circle of which Pierre was almost a member. "Today, when I remembered that all these delightful associations must be broken off, and then, you know, André..." She looked significantly at her husband. "I'm afraid. I'm afraid," she whispered, and a shudder ran down her back. Her husband looked at her as if surprised to notice that someone besides Pierre and himself was in the room, and addressed her in a tone of frigid politeness. "What is it you're afraid of, Lise? I don't understand," said he.
"There, what egotists men all are. All egotists. Just for a whim of his own, goodness only knows why, he leaves me and locks me up alone in the country."
"With my father and sister, remember," said Prince Andrew gently.
alone all the same, without my friends, and he expects me not to be afraid. Her tone was now querulous, and her lip drawn up, giving her not a joyful but an animal, squirrel-like expression. She paused as if she felt it indecorous to speak of her pregnancy before Pierre, though the gist of the matter lay in that. "I still can't understand what you're afraid of," said Prince Andrew slowly, not taking his eyes off his wife. The princess blushed and raised her arms with a gesture of despair. "No, Andrew, I must say you have changed. Oh, how you have—"
"Your doctor tells you to go to bed earlier," said Prince Andrew. "You'd better go."
The princess said nothing, but suddenly her short, downy lip quivered. Prince Andrew rose, shrugged his shoulders, and walked about the room. Pierre looked over his spectacles with naive surprise, now at him and now at her, moved as if about to rise too, but changed his mind. "Why should I mind Monsieur Pierre being here?" exclaimed the little princess suddenly, her pretty face all at once distorted by a tearful grimace. "I've long wanted to ask you, Andrew, why you have changed so to me. What have I done to you? You're going to the war and have no pity for me. Why is it?"
"Please," was all Prince Andrew said. But that one word expressed an entreaty, a threat, and above all, conviction that she would herself regret her words. But she went on hurriedly.
You treat me like an invalid or a child. I see it all. Did you behave like that 6 months ago?"
"Lise, I beg you to desist," said Prince Andrew still more emphatically.
Pierre, who had been growing more and more agitated as he listened to all this, rose and approached the princess. He seemed unable to bear the sight of tears and was ready to cry himself. "Calm yourself, princess. It seems so to you because, I assure you, I myself have experienced it, and so because... No, excuse me, an outsider is out of place here. No, don't distress yourself. Goodbye."
Prince Andrew caught him by the hand.
"No, wait, Pierre. The princess is too kind to wish to deprive me of the pleasure of spending the evening with you." "No, he thinks only of himself," muttered the princess without restraining her angry tears.
"Lise," said Prince Andrew dryly, raising his voice to the pitch which indicates that patience is exhausted.
Suddenly the angry, squirrel-like expression of the princess's pretty face changed into a winning and piteous look of fear. Her beautiful eyes glanced askance at her husband's face, and her own assumed the timid, deprecating expression of a dog when it rapidly but feebly wags its drooping tail. Mon Dieu," she muttered, and lifting her dress with one hand, she went up to her husband and kissed him on the forehead.
"Good night, please," said he, rising and courteously kissing her hand as he would have done to a stranger.
The friends were silent. Neither cared to begin talking. Pierre continually glanced at Prince Andrew. Prince Andrew rubbed his forehead with his small hand. "Let us go and have supper," he said with a sigh, going to the door. They entered the elegant, newly decorated and luxurious dining room. Everything, from the table napkins to the silver, china, and glass, bore that imprint of newness found in the households of the newly married. Halfway through supper, Prince Andrew leaned his elbows on the table, and with a look of nervous agitation such as Pierre had never before seen on his face, began to talk, as one who has long had something on his mind and suddenly determines to speak out. "Never, never marry, my dear fellow. That's my advice. Never marry till you can say to yourself that you have done all you're capable of, and until you have ceased to love the woman of your choice and have seen her plainly as she is, or else you will make a cruel and irrevocable mistake. Marry when you're old and good for nothing, or all that is good and noble in you will be lost. It will all be wasted on trifles. Yes, 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 don't look at me with such surprise. If you marry expecting anything from yourself in the future, you will feel at every step that for you all is ended. All is closed except the drawing room, where you will be ranged side by side with a court lackey and an idiot. But what's the good?" And he waved his arm. Pierre took off his spectacles, which made his face seem different, and the good-natured expression still more apparent, and gazed at his friend in amazement.
My wife, continued Prince Andrew, is an excellent woman, one of those rare women with whom a man's honor is safe. But, oh God, what would I not give now to be unmarried? You're the first and only one to whom I mention this because I like you. As he said this, Prince Andrew was less than ever like that Bolkonsky who had lolled in Anna Pavlovna's easy chairs and with half-closed eyes had uttered French phrases between his teeth. Every muscle of his thin face was now quivering with nervous excitement. His eyes, in which the fire of life had seemed extinguished, now flashed with brilliant light. It was evident that the more lifeless he seemed at ordinary times, the more impassioned he became in these moments of almost morbid irritation. You don't understand why I say this, he continued, but it is the whole story of life. You talk of Bonaparte and his career, said he, though Pierre had not mentioned Bonaparte. But Bonaparte, when he worked, went step by step toward his goal. He was free, he had nothing but his aim to consider, and he reached it. But tie yourself up with a woman, and like a chained convict, you lose all freedom, and all you have of hope and strength merely weighs you down and torments you with regret. Drawing rooms, gossip, balls, vanity, and triviality, these are the enchanted circle I cannot escape from. I'm now going to the war, the greatest war there ever was, and I know nothing and am fit for nothing. I'm very amiable and have a caustic wit, continued Prince Andrew, and at Anna Pavlovna's they listened to me. And that stupid set without whom my wife cannot exist, and those women, if you only knew what those society women are, and women in general. My father is right. Selfish, vain, stupid, trivial in everything. That's what women are when you see them in their true colors. When you meet them in society, it seems as if there was something in them, but there's nothing, nothing, nothing. No, don't marry, my dear fellow. Don't marry, concluded Prince Andrew. It seems funny to me, said Pierre, that you should consider yourself incapable and your life a spoiled life. Well, you have everything before you, everything. And you... He did not finish his sentence, but his tone showed how highly he thought of his friend and how much he expected of him in the future. How can he talk like that, thought Pierre. He considered his friend a model of perfection because Prince Andrew possessed in the highest degree just the very qualities Pierre lacked, and which might be best described as strength of will. Pierre was always astonished at Prince Andrew's calm manner of treating everybody, his extraordinary memory, his extensive reading. He had read everything, knew everything, and had an opinion about everything. But above all, at his capacity for work and study. And if Pierre was often struck by Andrew's lack of capacity for philosophical meditation, to which he himself was particularly addicted, he regarded even this not as a defect, but as a sign of strength. Even in the best, most friendly, and simplest relations of life, praise and commendation are essential, just as grease is necessary to wheels that they may run smoothly. My part is played out, said Prince Andrew. What's the use of talking about me? Let us talk about you, he added after a silence, smiling at his reassuring thoughts. That smile was immediately reflected on Pierre's face. But what is there to say about me? Said Pierre, his face relaxing into a careless, merry smile. What am I? An illegitimate son. He suddenly blushed crimson, and it was plain that he had made a great effort to say this. Without a name and without means. And it really... But he did not say what it really was. For the present, I'm free and am all right. Only I haven't the least idea what I am to do. I wanted to consult you seriously. Prince Andrew looked kindly at him, yet his glance, friendly and affectionate as it was, expressed a sense of his own superiority. I'm fond of you, especially as you are the one live man among our whole set. Yes, you're all right. Choose what you will, it's all the same. You'll be all right anywhere. But look here, give up visiting those Kuragins and leading that sort of life. It suits you so badly.
All this debauchery, dissipation, and the rest of it.
What would you have, my dear fellow? Answered Pierre, shrugging his shoulders.
Women, my dear fellow, women.
I don't understand it, replied Prince Andrew. Women who are comme il faut, that's a different matter, but the Kuragin set of women, women and wine, I don't understand.
Pierre was staying at Prince Vasily Kuragin's and sharing the dissipated life of his son Anatole, the son whom they were planning to reform by marrying him to Prince Andrew's sister.
Do you know, said Pierre, as if suddenly struck by a happy thought, seriously, I've long been thinking of it. Leading such a life, I can't decide or think properly about anything. One's head aches and one spends all one's money. He asked me for tonight, but I won't go.
You give me your word of honor not to go?
On my honor.
Chapter 3. Pierre at Anatole Kuragin's. Dolokhov's vet. It was past 1 o'clock when Pierre left his friend. It was a cloudless northern summer night. Pierre took an open cab, intending to drive straight home, but the nearer he drew to the house, the more he felt the impossibility of going to sleep on such a night. It was light enough to see a long way in the deserted street, and it seemed more like morning or evening than night. On the way, Pierre remembered that Anatole Kuragin was expecting the usual set for cards that evening, after which there was generally a drinking bout, finishing with visits of a kind Pierre was very fond of.
I should like to go to Kuragin's, thought he. But he immediately recalled his promise to Prince Andrew not to go there.
Then, as happens to people of weak character, he desired so passionately once more to enjoy that dissipation he was so accustomed to, that he decided to go. The thought immediately occurred to him that his promise to Prince Andrew was of no account, because before he gave it, he had already promised Prince Anatole to come to his gathering. Besides, thought he, all such words of honor are conventional things with no definite meaning, especially if one considers that by tomorrow one may be dead, or something so extraordinary may happen to one that honor and dishonor will be all the same. Pierre often indulged in reflections of this sort, nullifying all his decisions and intentions. He went to Kuragin. Reaching the large house near the Horse Guards barracks in which Anatole lived, Pierre entered the lighted porch, ascended the stairs, and went in at the open door. There was no one in the anteroom. Empty bottles, cloaks, and overshoes were lying about. There was a smell of alcohol and sounds of voices and shouting in the distance. Cards and supper were over, but the visitors had not yet dispersed. Pierre threw off his cloak and entered the first room in which were the remains of supper. A footman, thinking no one saw him, was drinking on the sly what was left in the glasses. From the third room came sounds of laughter, the shouting of familiar voices, the growling of a bear, and general commotion. Some 8 or 9 young men were crowding anxiously round an open window. 3 others were romping with a young bear, one pulling him by the chain and trying to set him at the others. "I bet 100 on Stevens," shouted one. "Mind, no holding on," cried another. "I bet on Dolokhov," cried a third. "Kuragin, you part our hands." The Russian custom was to shake hands on a bet, and for some third person acting as a witness to separate the hands. "There, leave Bruin alone. Here's a bet on." "At one draft or he loses," shouted a fourth. "Jacob, bring a bottle," shouted the host, a tall, handsome fellow who stood in the midst of the group without a coat and with his fine linen shirt unfastened in front. "Wait a bit, you fellows. Here's Pacher." "Good man," cried he, addressing Pierre. Another voice, from a man of medium height with clear blue eyes, particularly striking among all these drunken voices by its sober ring, cried from the window, "Come here, part the bets." This was Dolokhov, an officer of the Semyonov regiment, a notorious gambler and duelist, who was living with Anatole. Pierre smiled, looking about him merrily. "I don't understand. What's it all about?"
"Wait a bit. He's not drunk yet. A bottle here," said Anatole, and taking a glass from the table, he went up to Pierre. "First of all, you must drink."
Pierre drank one glass after another, looking from under his brows at the tipsy guests who were again crowding round the window and listening to their chatter.
Anatole kept on refilling Pierre's glass while explaining that Dolokhov was betting with Stevens, an English naval officer, that he would drink a bottle of rum sitting on the outer ledge of the third floor window with his legs hanging out.
"Go on, you must drink it all," said Anatole, giving Pierre the last glass, "or I won't let you go."
"No, I won't," said Pierre, pushing Anatole aside, and he went up to the window. Dolokhov was holding the Englishman's hand and clearly and distinctly repeating the terms of the bet, addressing himself particularly to Anatole and Pierre. Dolokhov was of medium height, with curly hair and light blue eyes. He was about 25. Like all infantry officers, he wore no moustache, so that his mouth, the most striking feature of his face, was clearly seen. The lines of that mouth were remarkably finely curved. The middle of the upper lip formed a sharp wedge and closed firmly on the firm lower one, and something like two distinct smiles played continually round the two corners of the mouth. This, together with the resolute, insolent intelligence of his eyes, produced an effect which made it impossible not to notice his face. Dolokhov was a man of small means and no connections. Yet, though Anatole spent tens of thousands of rubles, Dolokhov lived with him and had placed himself on such a footing that all who knew them, including Anatole himself, respected him more than they did Anatole. Dolokhov could play all games and nearly always won. However much he drank, he never lost his clear-headedness. Both Kuragin and Dolokhov were at that time notorious among the rakes and scapegraces of Petersburg. The bottle of rum was brought. The window frame, which prevented anyone from sitting on the outer sill, was being forced out by two footmen, who were evidently flurried and intimidated by the directions and shouts of the gentlemen around. Anatole, with his swaggering air, strode up to the window. He wanted to smash something. Pushing away the footman, he tugged at the frame but could not move it. He smashed a pane.
"You have a try, Hercules," said he, turning to Pierre.
Pierre seized the crossbeam, tugged, and wrenched the oak frame out with a crash.
"Take it right out, or they'll think I'm holding on," said Dolokhov. "Is the Englishman bragging, eh? Is it all right?" said Anatole.
"First rate," said Pierre, looking at Dolokhov, who, with a bottle of rum in his hand, was approaching the window from which the light of the sky, the dawn merging with the afterglow of sunset, was visible. Dolokhov, the bottle of rum still in his hand, jumped onto the window sill.
"Listen," cried he, standing there and addressing those in the room. All were silent. "I bet 50 imperials,"
note, about $380. The imperial was 10 rubles. The value of the ruble at par was at that time about 76 cents. The purchasing power of money in Russia was then very much higher than it has been in our generation.
"I bet 50 imperials."
He spoke French that the Englishman might understand him, but he did not speak it very well.
"I bet 50 imperials, or do you wish to make it 100?
Added he, addressing the Englishman.
"No, 50, replied the latter. "All right, 50 imperials, that I will drink a whole bottle of rum without taking it from my mouth, sitting outside the window on this spot."
He stooped and pointed to the sloping ledge outside the window.
"And without holding on to anything. Is that right?"
"Quite right," said the Englishman. Anatole turned to the Englishman, and taking him by one of the buttons of his coat and looking down at him, the Englishman was short, began repeating the terms of the wager to him in English.
"Wait," cried Dolokhov, hammering with the bottle on the windowsill to attract attention. "Wait a bit, Kuragin, listen. If anyone else does the same, I will pay him 100 imperials, you understand?"
The Englishman nodded, but gave no indication whether he intended to accept this challenge or not. Anatole did not release him, and though he kept nodding to show that he understood, Anatole went on translating Dolokhov's words into English. A thin young lad, an hussar of the Life Guards, who had been losing that evening, climbed on the windowsill, leaned over, and looked down.
"Ooh, ooh, ooh,"
he muttered, looking down from the window at the stones of the pavement.
"Shut up,"
cried Dolokhov, pushing him away from the window. The lad jumped awkwardly back into the room, tripping over his spurs. Placing the bottle on the windowsill where he could reach it easily, Dolokhov climbed carefully and slowly through the window and lowered his legs. Pressing against both sides of the window,
He adjusted himself on his seat, lowered his hands, moved a little to the right and then to the left, and took up the bottle. Anatole brought two candles and placed them on the windowsill, though it was already quite light. Dolokhov's back in his white shirt and his curly head were lit up from both sides. Everyone crowded to the window, the Englishman in front. Pierre stood smiling but silent. One man, older than the others present, suddenly pushed forward with a scared and angry look and wanted to seize hold of Dolokhov's shirt. "I say, this is folly. He'll be killed," said this more sensible man. Anatole stopped him. "Don't touch him. You'll startle him, and then he'll be killed, eh? What then? Eh?" Dolokhov turned round, and again holding on with both hands, arranged himself on his seat. "If anyone comes meddling again," said he, emitting the words separately through his thin, compressed lips, "I will throw him down there. Now then." Saying this, he again turned round, dropped his hands, took the bottle, and lifted it to his lips, threw back his head, and raised his free hand to balance himself. One of the footmen who had stooped to pick up some broken glass remained in that position without taking his eyes from the window and from Dolokhov's back. Anatole stood erect with staring eyes. The Englishman looked on sideways, pursing up his lips. The man who had wished to stop the affair ran to a corner of the room and threw himself on a sofa with his face to the wall. Pierre hid his face, from which a faint smile forgot to fade, though his features now expressed horror and fear. All was still. Pierre took his hand from his eyes. Dolokhov still sat in the same position, only his head was thrown further back till his curly hair touched his shirt collar, and the hand holding the bottle was lifted higher and higher and trembled with the effort. The bottle was emptying perceptibly and rising still higher, and his head tilting yet further back. "Why is it so long?" thought Pierre. It seemed to him that more than half an hour had elapsed. Suddenly, Dolokhov made a backward movement with his spine, and his arm trembled nervously. This was sufficient to cause his whole body to slip as he sat on the sloping ledge. As he began slipping down, his head and arm wavered still more with the strain. One hand moved as if to clutch the windowsill, but refrained from touching it. Pierre again covered his eyes and thought he would never open them again. Suddenly he was aware of a stir all around. He looked up. Dolokhov was standing on the windowsill with a pale but radiant face. "It's empty!" He threw the bottle to the Englishman, who caught it neatly. Dolokhov jumped down. He smelt strongly of rum.
"Well done, fine fellow. There's a bet for you. Devil take you," came from different sides.
The Englishman took out his purse and began counting out the money. Dolokhov stood frowning and did not speak. Pierre jumped upon the windowsill.
"Gentlemen, who wishes to bet with me? I'll do the same thing," he suddenly cried. "Even without a bet. There. Tell them to bring me a bottle. I'll do it. Bring a bottle."
"Let him do it. Let him do it," said Dolokhov, smiling.
"Well, what next? Have you gone mad? No one would let you. Why, you go giddy even on a staircase," exclaimed several voices. "I'll drink it. Let's have a bottle of rum," shouted Pierre, banging the table with a determined and drunken gesture and preparing to climb out of the window.
They seized him by his arms, but he was so strong that everyone who touched him was sent flying.
"No, you'll never manage him that way," said Anatole. "Wait a bit and I'll get round him. Listen, listen. I'll take your bet tomorrow. But now we're all going to blanks." "Oh, come on, then," cried Pierre. "Come on, and we'll take Bruin with us."
And he caught the bear, took it in his arms, lifted it from the ground, and began dancing round the room with it. Chapter 4. A Name Day at the Rostovs. Prince Vasily kept the promise he had given to Princess Drubetskaya, who had spoken to him on behalf of her only son Boris on the evening of Anna Pavlovna's soiree. The matter was mentioned to the emperor, an exception made, and Boris transferred into the regiment of Semyonov Guards with the rank of cornet. He received, however, no appointment to Kutuzov's staff, despite all Anna Mikhailovna's endeavors and entreaties. Soon after Anna Pavlovna's reception, Anna Mikhailovna returned to Moscow and went straight to her rich relations, the Rostovs, with whom she stayed when in the town,
and where her darling Boris, who had only just entered a regiment of the line and was being at once transferred to the guards as a cornet, had been educated from childhood and lived for years at a time. The guards had already left Petersburg on the 10th of August, and her son, who had remained in Moscow for his equipment, was to join them on the march to Radzivilov, a frontier town where the Russian army, going to the assistance of Austria, was to cross into Galicia. It was St. Natalia's Day, and the name day of two of the Rostovs, the mother and the youngest daughter, both named Natalie. Ever since the morning, carriages with six horses had been coming and going continually, bringing visitors to the Countess Rostova's big house on the Povarskaya, so well known to all Moscow. The Countess herself and her handsome eldest daughter were in the drawing room with the visitors who came to congratulate, and who constantly succeeded one another in relays. The Countess was a woman of about 45, with a thin oriental type of face, evidently worn out with childbearing. She had had 12. A languor of motion and speech resulting from weakness gave her a distinguished air which inspired respect. Princess Anna Mikhailovna Drubetskaya, who, as a member of the household, was also seated in the drawing room, helped to receive and entertain the visitors. The young people were in one of the inner rooms, not considering it necessary to take part in receiving the visitors. The Count met the guests and saw them off, inviting them all to dinner. "I am very, very grateful to you, mon cher, or ma chère." He called everyone without exception and without the slightest variation in his tone, my dear, whether they were above or below him in rank. "I thank you for myself and for our two dear ones whose name day we are keeping. But mind you come to dinner, or I shall be offended, ma chère. On behalf of the whole family, I beg you to come, mon cher." These words he repeated to everyone without exception or variation, and with the same expression on his full, cheerful, clean-shaven face, the same firm pressure of the hand, and the same quick, repeated bows. As soon as he had seen a visitor off, he returned to one of those who were still in the drawing-room, drew a chair toward him or her, and, jauntily spreading out his legs and putting his hands on his knees with the air of a man who enjoys life and knows how to live, he swayed to and fro with dignity, offered surmises about the weather, or touched on questions of health, sometimes in Russian, and sometimes in very bad but self-confident French. Then again, like a man weary but unflinching in the fulfillment of duty, he rose to see some visitors off, and, stroking his scanty gray hairs over his bald patch, also asked them to dinner. Sometimes on his way back from the anteroom he would pass through the conservatory and pantry into the large marble dining hall, where tables were being set out for 80 people, and looking at the footmen who were bringing in silver and china, moving tables and unfolding damask table linen, he would call Dmitri Vasilievich, a man of good family and the manager of all his affairs, and while looking with pleasure at the enormous table would say, "Well, Dmitri, you'll see that things are all as they should be." "That's right. The great thing is the serving, that's it." And with a complacent sigh, he would return to the drawing room. "Marya Lvovna Karagina and her daughter," announced the Countess's gigantic footman in his bass voice, entering the drawing room. The Countess reflected a moment and took a pinch from a gold snuff box with her husband's portrait on it. "I'm worn out by these callers. However, I'll see her and no more. She is so affected." "Ask her in," she said to the footman in a sad voice, as if saying, "Very well, finish me off." A tall, stout, and proud-looking woman, with a round-faced, smiling daughter, entered the drawing-room, their dresses rustling. "Dear Countess, what an age! She's been laid up, poor child, at the Razumovsky's ball, and Countess Apraksin. I was so delighted," came the sounds of animated feminine voices interrupting one another and mingling with the rustling of dresses and the scraping of chairs. Then one of those conversations began which last out until at the first pause the guests rise with a rustle of dresses and say, "I'm so delighted, Mama's health, and Countess Apraksina," and then again rustling pass into the anteroom, put on cloaks or mantles, and drive away. The conversation was on the chief topic of the day, the illness of the wealthy and celebrated beau of Catherine's day, Count Bezukhov, and about his illegitimate son Pierre, the one who had behaved so improperly at Anna Pavlovna's reception. "'I'm so sorry for the poor Count,' said the visitor. "'He's in such bad health, and now this vexation about his son is enough to kill him.' "'What is that?' asked the Countess, as if she did not know what the visitor alluded to, though she had already heard about the cause of Count Bezukhov's distress some 15 times. "'That's what comes of a modern education,' exclaimed the visitor. "'It seems that while he was abroad, this young man was allowed to do as he liked, and now in Petersburg I hear he's been doing such terrible things that he has been expelled by the police.' "'You don't say so,' replied the Countess. "'He chose his friends badly,' interposed Anna Mikhailovna. "'Prince Vasily's son, he and a certain Dolohov, have, it is said, been up to heaven only knows what, and they've had to suffer for it. Dolohov has been degraded to the ranks, and Bezukhov's son sent back to Moscow. Anatole Kuragin's father managed somehow to get his son's affair hushed up, but even he was ordered out of Petersburg. "'But what have they been up to?' asked the Countess. "'They are regular brigands, especially Dolohov,' replied the visitor. "'He's the son of Maria Ivanovna Dolohova, such a worthy woman, but there, just fancy, those three got hold of a bear somewhere, put it in a carriage, and set off with it to visit some actresses. The police tried to interfere, and what did the young man do? They tied a policeman and the bear back to back and put the bear into the Moika Canal.' And there was the bear swimming about with a policeman on his back.
"'What a nice figure the policeman must have cut, my dear!' shouted the Count, dying with laughter. "'Oh, how dreadful! How can you laugh at it, Count?'
Yet the ladies themselves could not help laughing.
"'It was all they could do to rescue the poor man,' continued the visitor. "'And to think it is Cyril Vladimirovich Bezukhov's son who amuses himself in this sensible manner.' "'And he was said to be so well educated and clever. "'This is all that his foreign education has done for him. "'I hope that here in Moscow no one will receive him in spite of his money. "'They wanted to introduce him to me, but I quite declined. "'I have my daughters to consider.'
"'Why do you say this young man is so rich?' asked the Countess, "'turning away from the girls, who at once assumed an air of inattention. "'His children are all illegitimate. "'I think Pierre also is illegitimate.' The visitor made a gesture with her hand. I should think he has a score of them. Princess Anna Mikhailovna intervened in the conversation, evidently wishing to show her connections and knowledge of what went on in society.
The fact of the matter is, said she significantly, and also in a half whisper, everyone knows Count Cyril's reputation. He has lost count of his children, but this Pierre was his favorite.
"'How handsome the old man still was only a year ago,' remarked the Countess. "'I've never seen a handsomer man.' "'He's very much altered now,' said Anna Mikhailovna.
"'Well, as I was saying, Prince Vasily is the next heir through his wife, "'but the Count is very fond of Pierre, "'looked after his education and wrote to the Emperor about him, "'so that in the case of his death, and he's so ill that he may die at any moment, "'and Dr. Lorrain has come from Petersburg,' No one knows who will inherit his immense fortune, Pierre or Prince Vasily. 40,000 serfs and millions of rubles. I know it all very well, for Prince Vasily told me himself. Besides, Cyril Vladimirovich is my mother's second cousin. He's also my body's godfather, she added, as if she attached no importance at all to the fact.
Prince Vasily arrived in Moscow yesterday. I hear he has come on some inspection business, remarked the visitor.
"'Yes, but between ourselves,' said the princess, "'that is a pretext. "'The fact is, he has come to see Count Cyril Vladimirovich, "'hearing how ill he is.'
"'But do you know, my dear, that was a capital joke,' said the Count.
"'And seeing that the elder visitor was not listening, "'he turned to the young ladies.
"'I can just imagine what a funny figure that policeman cut.'
And as he waved his arms to impersonate the policeman, "'his portly form again shook with a deep ringing laugh. The laugh of one who always eats well, and in particular drinks well.
So do come and dine with us, he said.
Chapter 5. Natasha and Boris. Silence ensued. The Countess looked at her callers, smiling affably, but not concealing the fact that she would not be distressed if they now rose and took their leave. The visitor's daughter was already smoothing down her dress with an inquiring look at her mother, when suddenly from the next room were heard the footsteps of boys and girls running to the door and the noise of a chair falling over, and a girl of 13, hiding something in the folds of her short muslin frock, darted in and stopped short in the middle of the room. It was evident that she had not intended her flight to bring her so far. Behind her in the doorway appeared a student with a crimson coat collar, an officer of the guards, a girl of 15, and a plump, rosy-faced boy in a short jacket. The Count jumped up, and swaying from side to side, spread his arms wide and threw them round the little girl who had run in.
"Ah, here she is!" he exclaimed, laughing. "My pet, whose name day it is, my dear pet!"
"Ma chère, there is a time for everything," said the Countess with feigned severity. "You spoil her, il y a?" she added, turning to her husband. "How do you do, my dear? I wish you many happy returns of your name day," said the visitor. "What a charming child," she added, addressing the mother. This black-eyed, wide-mouthed girl, not pretty but full of life, with childish bare shoulders which after her run heaved and shook her bodice, with black curls tossed backward, thin bare arms, little legs in lace-frilled drawers, and feet in low slippers, was just at that charming age when a girl is no longer a child, though the child is not yet a young woman. Escaping from her father, she ran to hide her flushed face in the lace of her mother's mantilla, not paying the least attention to her severe remark, and began to laugh. She laughed, and in fragmentary sentences tried to explain about a doll which she produced from the folds of her frock.
"Do you see, my doll, Mimi, you see?"
was all Natasha, Natalie, managed to utter. To her, everything seemed funny. She leaned against her mother and burst into such a loud, ringing fit of laughter that even the prim visitor could not help joining in. "Now then, go away and take your monstrosity with you," said the mother, pushing away her daughter with pretended sternness. And turning to the visitor, she added, "She is my youngest girl." Natasha, raising her face for a moment from her mother's mantilla, glanced up at her through tears of laughter and again hid her face. The visitor, compelled to look on at this family scene, thought it necessary to take some part in it. "Tell me, my dear," said she to Natasha, "is Mimi a relation of yours? A daughter, I suppose?"